Point Mets fans, welcome back to Amazing Avenue Audio, the show. I am Brian. With me, as always, is Chris. And we are recording this as the Mets just dropped a 5-1 game to the Nationals, started by Wilmer Font, who was acquired to be, I guess, maybe a swingman, a long reliever, a spot starter, and has now made a couple of starts for the Mets, and looked okay in his first start, looked less okay this start, not lasting three innings, gave up five runs, walked two. I don't know what to say about the Mets starting pitching right now. You had a really interesting sort of take on this when we were texting about this earlier. So I want you to start, and then I'm going to kind of argue with you, but kind of agree with you. So tell me what you said about the Mets pitching.
Well, it's just so top heavy might not even be the right word. It's there's three guys who look like they're doing, you know, what we'd expect them to do. And that's it. You know, it's hard when you have three and a half starting pitchers, and that half is either, you know, generously assigned to Steven Matz, or a quarter of it is, you know, or half of the half. So one quarter is Matz and the other is Font. Yeah, I don't know. I just don't. It's the ultimate frustrating Mets thing. You know, the DeGrom, Syndergaard, Wheeler majority of the rotation has been outstanding lately. I think it was Mike Puma. If not, apologies to the wrong or getting the beat right or wrong. But I think it was Mike Puma who pointed out before tonight's game, the Mets have 2 point something ERA, second best in baseball so far in May. And it's 2 weeks. You know, I don't think it was designed for anybody to take that too seriously. But yeah, I don't know. It's just you have super exciting, good pitching and just nothing. And I don't believe that Steven Matz is going to pitch this weekend. I will be pleasantly surprised if he pitches in May. I won't be shocked if he doesn't pitch until July. You know, it's just...
Is that just because of Matz's injury history you feel that way?
Yeah, and I mean, unless over the last couple of days I missed something, that he threw a bullpen and it went great and he had no issues whatsoever.
Now I got to look this up.
Even then, I'm skeptical. But, you know, when this started, this elbow thing, it came up, okay, it's his elbow. He's going to get it checked out. He couldn't complete a bullpen, and that's why we got him examined. That was alarm bells and flags and everything to me, you know? So it's...
So Matz is going to throw a side session, it looks like probably tomorrow, before they decide when he's going to start.
Okay.
So I said I was going to somewhat argue with your position here. I will argue that Steven Matz has been one of the more consistent pitchers for the Mets this season thus far. And that if Matz is back, I think that they have four legitimate starting pitchers. Now, granted, you know, I'm cherry picking a little bit here. I'm not going to totally dismiss that game he didn't get a single out in, but even with that game, he's pitching to a 3.86 ERA. You know, he is not walking many people. His walks are way down. You know, he's only walked nine people over seven starts. That's quite good, especially because Matz is a guy who in the past has struggled with his control a little bit. You know, he is not striking out a ton of batters, but he's not giving up a ton of hard contact either. Aside from that one truly horrible start, he has not given up more than three earned runs in a single start. You know, he's pitching pretty well right now. And I think when he comes back, if he comes back healthy, then the Mets have a slightly less terrible problem, which is still coming up with a fifth starter and a sixth starter and ideally a seventh starter, so we don't have to see Vargas or Font or Oswalt or insert quad A arm here in there.
But Flexen.
Flexen, yeah. But I don't think Matt's, I hope Matt's is not as hurt as you fear he is. And I think that when Matt's has been healthy, I think Matt's has been absolutely fine for the Mets this year.
Yeah. I can't argue with the performance. I think I'm just at a point where giving them the benefit of the doubt, whether it can be the individual player, the team as a whole, it's just tough to give the benefit of the doubt on an injury timeline at this point. So if he gets out there and makes a start, then I'll bring it up to, they have a whopping 4 major league starting pitchers, which is still not good.
No, it's not.
It wouldn't be so frustrating if they had seen it coming. If they had gone out and gotten somebody, sure, it would be disappointing if they had gone and gotten somebody, realizing Vargas wasn't the answer, Mass is hurt, and now we're shuffling through long man Jason Vargas has to make some starts, or anybody else who you just mentioned has to make some starts. But, you know, today I saw somebody reference Font as a spot starter. It's like, it's his second time through the rotation.
And he might get a third time through.
Right. And, okay, sure, he doesn't pitch more than 4 innings, but he's still starting in a turn in the rotation.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the negative side of it.
What's especially frustrating to me is that even when this started happening, the Mets still were comfortable doing nothing. You know, looking at, and I know every week it's like my job to bring up Gio Gonzalez because I wanted the Mets to sign him in the offseason, but Gio Gonzalez made 3 starts for the Brewers so far. He has given up a total of 3 earned runs in those 3 starts. He's walked 4 people. He has gone at least 5 innings in every start he's made. He is throwing to a 1.69 ERA. Again, all this is small sample size. I'm, you know, sing the Ted Berg song. I get it. But if those 3 starts were made for the Mets instead of 2 Font starts and a Vargas start, the Mets could be in a considerably better position right now.
Yeah. Hey, they're convinced he's only a marginal upgrade.
I think the evidence is just proving that incorrect every time he takes the mound or someone else takes the mound.
Right. And the thing is with him in particular, and once again, Dallas Keuchel is still available.
Yes, agreed.
But with Gonzalez getting the contract he got with the Brewers and basically having it come out after the fact that the Mets may have been interested but weren't willing to guarantee him any playing time, I don't know. That makes it even more frustrating. There was that aspect of it. There was also the report that they were worried about, what if he's bad? Shortly before they DFA'd Travis d'Arnaud.
I was just going to say that. Yeah.
They didn't have to tender a contract and called up a Danny Hechevarria who, I don't want to say he's useless, but he's not really doing anything that Guillorme can't do.
He is older, more expensive, Louis Guillorme.
Right.
Yeah.
And now, you know, he's got a spot in the 40. He's earning actual money, not just the league minimum. You know, you add these things up and it starts to get concerning that there's always an excuse for what you don't do.
Right.
You know, whether they play it off as we tried really hard to get this guy, or if they just dismiss and say like, nah, we just weren't interested for whatever reason. But, you know, when you present it as, oh, what if we pay him and then he's bad? Do they ever think to themselves, what if somebody else pays him and he's good?
Right. And we're not talking a lot of money here. This isn't Keuchel money.
Right, no, this is 4 minor league, not minor leaguers, sorry. It's the equivalent of 4 league minimum
yeah.
Guys. And you do have to, you know, have 25 players on a roster. It's not a huge jump. If you wanted to argue, and based on what we've read with Keuchel, from Ken Rosenthal, and I'm trying to remember if anybody else had some of the specific details, but Keuchel sounds like what he's asking for isn't totally astronomical. He may have started the offseason that way, but you could at least make an argument that Keuchel is holding it too strong with his demands. And I would still disagree with you, but you could make an argument for, look, he's, you know, he's over 30. He's not quite the pitcher he used to be. He wants to get paid like the pitcher he used to be. I'm not comfortable with that for the Mets.
I mean, we're also talking at this point, he would need minimum of a month to get ready. So, you know, injuries are happening. You don't sign Dallas Keuchel and bring him up next week. That's not happening.
I mean, they might.
Well, they might. Sure, they might.
But they seem to think that rehab assignments don't matter for pitchers anymore.
That is very true. but, you know, to me, again, not to keep being the Geo guy, but, like, Gonzalez was pitching in the high minors. He was able to come up and right away join the rotation. And, you know, I can't really fault them for going, for going after Font. I think Font was a fine flyer to take. You know, you got to take those guys over the course of a season. You know, you have to. But Font isn't going to wind up doing a goddamn thing. That's my problem, you know? Just, I feel like Font was literally the path of least resistance. Hey, look, we're going after a guy. He's going to be able to give us some starts, and when everyone's healthy, he'll work out of the bullpen, and it's fine. That guy could have been Gio Gonzalez for not that much more money and a much longer track record and likely a much better performance.
Yeah, man. And there's part of this that feels like they're holding on for Anthony Kay and Cespedes. Which is... And I'm as pro-Cespedes as you can get. And, you know, love the guy. And he's not a pitcher. So he doesn't tie in directly to this. But it just starts feeling that way, that the team is once again looking at, well, we like what we've got. And these guys don't cost us any new money. It's if we hear about, you know, in July, hey, Cespedes is progressing and we think he might be back in mid-August. That seems like an optimistic scenario. But let's say that's the case and they want to pull out their favorite oldie but goodie that just gets passed down from GM to GM. You know, it's like a trade deadline acquisition. We get the best trade chip.
Yep.
I would love for them to treat the money the same way. Yeah, this guy's here and we have to pay him now. Even though the insurance was covering everything else, I'd love for them to try to have those things match up. I don't know if what I'm saying is making any sense.
No, but I definitely understand what you're saying. And to me, there's just some very obvious holes in that he's the best trade acquisition we can get at the deadline argument. Number one being that right now, I mean, yes, tonight the Mets needed offense, but right now the offense isn't really the problem. And if it is the problem, it's a problem of like streakiness and luck, etc. The team is built off. The team is deep offensively. Whether everybody is hitting at the moment is a thing to debate and to discuss. But ultimately, the team is built well offensively. I mean, if Cespedes comes back, and we've talked about this before, we're not going to spend too much time on it tonight. If Cespedes comes back, there gets to be some really hard conversations about playing time for various offensive players. That's a real thing. This team is deep offensively. The team is not deep defensively. I mean, it's not deep pitching-wise. And right now, that is the biggest problem they have. And I know that their farm system is not overflowing with people who they can trade for quality starting pitching. I'm not going to go back in time and relitigate the offseason. It just seems to me like this team has not been very good in the very small, again, tiny sample size, in the very short Brody Van Wagenen era. It seems to me like this team is not very well prepared for when things that you expect to go wrong. Like, nobody could have been prepared for Michael Conforto swinging his shoulder off, right?
Right.
That's not an injury that happens typically, so you can't be prepared for that. But how could the Mets have not been prepared for needing another starting pitcher?
Yeah. And I don't think they came into the season looking at Anthony Kay and thinking, hey, this guy's going to take Vargas's spot. I think he's gotten off to an impressive start, and you've started to see some mentions among the beat reporters that he's caught their eye and they're paying attention and all that. You know, he might be on the horizon in one way, shape, or form, but that wasn't the offseason plan. No,
that was not how they wrote it up in December.
Right. Anthony Kay wasn't in the discussion when they supposedly made up the Edwin Diaz rule.
Right, exactly.
So, if I want to be an optimist on the pitching side, it is awesome to see the other three, the three dudes who are healthy and major league pitchers doing awesome things. To the point about the May ERA, even through 2 weeks, those three had pitched coming into tonight, and it didn't change that drastically. But they had pitched 56% of the team's innings so far this month, in part because of off days and rainouts, and other other pitchers who were starting in the other slots not going that long in games anyway. You know, it's that's great. It's just not how it breaks down over the long haul. You don't get a majority of your innings thrown by three of your starting pitchers.
Right. Right.
Hey, everybody. I'm Neil Patel, editor-in-chief of The Verge, and this is The Vergecast. Vergecast is the flagship podcast of The Verge. Every week, we cover the latest in tech news and reviews. We take a critical look at what is going on now and next in the world of tech. The show is hosted by me, our executive editor, Dieter Bohn.
Not your friend.
And Paul Miller.
It just feels like there's something wrong with all computers, though. Don't you think that sometimes?
We do that on Fridays, and on Tuesdays, we have an interview episode. I've been talking to all kinds of influential people in and around the world of tech. We talked to Microsoft founder Bill Gates about his philanthropic efforts.
You can design systems without having to reveal any individual's particular medical record.
Journalists and academics like Lena Khan, who thinks that we should be doing way more to break up giant companies like Amazon and Facebook.
I think in hindsight, allowing Facebook to buy up both WhatsApp and Instagram proved to have been the wrong call.
And we talked to tech CEOs like Vizio's Bill Baxter, who explained exactly how smart TV manufacturers make their money.
It's about post-purchase monetization of the TV.
It's ads. Check us out every Friday to hear about everything in tech, from new iPhone leaks to breaking down Facebook's ongoing issues of privacy to just me and Paul ranting at each other about the role of the government. And check us out on Tuesdays when I host the interview episode. Subscribe to The Vergecast wherever podcasts are served. We'll see you then.
I'm Todd Vanderwerf, the host of Primetime, a new show from Vox.com. This season, we're tackling the American presidency on TV. Stories that capture the way television affects and reflects politics and culture. We'll take a look at fictional presidents who've changed the way we think about the real Oval Office.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Good morning, everyone. Please, take your seats.
And how real presidents use TV to further their own goals.
What did you come here to plug?
Have you heard of the Affordable Care Act?
From the first TV president.
People have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
To arguably the last.
We are fighting the fake news. It's fake, phony, fake.
Primetime, from the Vox Media Podcast Network and Vox.com. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah. I had a thought while we were talking, and we did not discuss this, so I'm sorry I'm throwing a topic at you without prior knowledge here, but how much of this do you think it can or will be argued by that this is Brody's first go-round as a GM?
What do you mean? Like, what specifically?
Like, at the end of the season, when the Mets missed the playoffs.
Ah, okay.
Is he going to say, like, listen, I didn't realize how much starting pitching depth we needed. It's my first time doing this. I'll be better next time.
I don't think so. I could see... I don't think he'll say that.
Well, I don't mean him, but do you think somebody... Do you think that's going to be the position the team takes?
Right. Somebody puts that out into the universe.
Yes.
Hey, for a season as a GM, we're happy with the moves he made. We're going to give him all the resources he needs to make this team even better and push us back to the playoffs, blah, 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 blah.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, I could see. I mean, if you're a public facing Mets employee, I could see you getting thrown under the bus in a flat out kind of way or in a backhanded compliment kind of way. It wouldn't be that shocking. Yeah, if it plays out that way and they, let's say Callaway lasts the season, but they fire him at the end of the season. You know, look, Brody went out. We had a winning record. Let's give him some benefit of the doubt here, whether it's warranted or not. But we won 85 games. We came up short. Brody, for his first season as a GM, we're happy with what he did. And now he's picking the next manager of this team.
He'll pick his guy.
And that's when everything's going to click.
Yeah.
I'd give him another offseason and his manager, and we're in great shape. I can see that, totally.
Do you think that that's a valid position to take?
No. I mean, so every winter it's sort of this game that we get stuck in with who's making the decisions. And I think a lot of Mets fans who have been around for the last decade, really, you know, 2006, 2007, 2008, obviously there was heartbreak involved to end all of those seasons, but those were good teams.
Yes.
Those were competitive teams. You could go back with hindsight and tweak some things here or there to make them, you know, make them all better, put them all over the top. But those were good, contending, competitive teams. Not the best in Mets history with 7 and 8. And 2006 wasn't technically either, but that was one of the most dominant seasons the team's ever had.
Yes.
But that era ends.
And also that era was really done in by injuries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the 2006 team, if they had their healthy starting pitching, I think it's a very different story.
Yeah. Yeah. And they got pretty far without it.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, sorry, but, go ahead.
Yeah, no, so if you've been tuned in for this last decade, you've had this sort of endless cycle. Oh, was it the GM who made this decision or who went with this guy who was cheaper instead of this other guy who was more expensive? Or was it the Wilpons? And I think they've enjoyed having the flexibility, you know, payroll flexibility is the infamous phrase. But I think that flexibility to deflect blame or make it a mystery, put it out into the universe that it could be the GM's call. There were years there where it was like, well, Sandy Alderson, he just doesn't like spending money. You know, that's all it is. That kind of messaging, whether it wasn't coming out in press releases, but things that would come up and get said. And I think that benefits them. The more that we try to figure it out, play the finger pointing game within the Mets, I think we lose sight of it. And I think a lot of people have gotten to a point that they will chalk it up to the Wilpons. I don't think anybody saw this offseason happen and said, Brody Van Wagenen doesn't realize that Manny Machado was good.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
There are some other decisions that have been made that make me question what exactly they prioritize or what they weight heavily. Things that we've already mentioned in this episode, but I think he realizes that Manny Machado is, I said good, but great. One of the better players in all the baseball. I think he knows Bryce Harper is really, really good. I don't think he was the one who decided, we're not going to even consider these guys.
I agree with that.
So, yeah, this is it's all focused on the pitching. We've gone a little bit all over the place, but that sort of sums up the Mets.
Yeah, exactly. And you mentioned this before, and we had talked about this before the show, so I do want to get to this. But, one of the reasons that Mickey Callaway was hired to be the Mets manager was his experience as a pitching coach. And that the Mets felt, or at least the Wilpons had felt like, and Alderson, I'll put this on him too, felt like the Mets needed a manager who had more experience dealing with pitchers. And he was billed as this, pitching coach phenom who was going to really be a positive force for the pitchers on the team. And maybe all the pitchers on the team love Mickey. I don't know. I'm not on the clubhouse. But it seems to me like most of his gaffes that he's made as a manager have been directly related to the pitching staff. And so I know we have no say in the matter. I know we have no inside information. If the Mets do not succeed this season, if they don't make the playoffs, if they don't keep it close to the final week of the season, is there any chance that Callaway is back next year?
I'm going to say no.
Like, he's got to win right now, I think, to keep his job.
Yeah. Whether or not it's fair is another question.
Absolutely. That's not what I'm asking.
And I'm not his biggest supporter either. But, yeah, I think he'd have to at least get them to the playoffs to keep the job.
You don't think if he keeps them in until the end of the season and they fight real hard, you don't think that's enough?
Maybe. Certainly if they don't have a winning record, he's gone.
Okay.
I guess I would bet on him being gone without a playoff appearance, even if it's just the wild card game. But your scenario is reasonable. I could see them making the case. You're one. Same thing with Brody, except it's 2 years in.
Right.
Hey, we're really happy.
I could also see them pointing to the injuries as a reason why he didn't succeed.
Yeah.
Depending on what the injury situation looks like at the end of the season. It's hard to tell that now.
Right. Right now, they've been pretty lucky. They haven't really had injuries.
Well, that's not true.
Okay. They for a normal baseball team, especially the Mets, sure, Lowry has been gone. And we're dealing with this Mats Vargas thing right now. So it's not nothing. But Conforto, Alonso, McNeil, DeGrom, Syndergaard, Wheeler, Rosario, Nimmo,
Diaz.
Yeah, Edwin Diaz, Cano. They've all been healthy. I guess, okay, Familia and Justin Wilson. So it's not zero, but
it's within the normal scope of injuries for a team to have had in the first 6 weeks of the season.
Right. They're not the Yankees.
Right.
On the injury front, so
Or on any front, really. but
well, yeah,
that's a different story altogether. I have mixed feelings about Calloway. You know, on one hand, I think that Calloway seems like a guy who maybe could keep the clubhouse motivated. He seems like a pretty good motivator. That's important, I suppose. You know, we have debated in the past, and I don't have an answer, of sort of how important a manager is in terms of a team's success over the course of a season. I don't think that it's nothing. I don't think it's everything either. And so on one hand, I think that you got to give Calloway the opportunity to learn on the job. And I think that the plus side of him working with Alderson was that Alderson wasn't going to go out and make the splashy moves that Van Wagenen made. And so he probably would have bought himself another year of middling Mets teams to learn on the job for. You're right now seeing him thrown into the lion's den of, you know, we're supposed to be winning games. We're supposed to be competing in the toughest division in baseball, theoretically. And, you know, that's a lot for him to take on his shoulders. And so I feel bad for the guy that he has unfair expectations thrust upon him. On the other hand, I think he has made just about every bonehead move he could make on and off the field, from fishing with DJ TJ, Donald Trump Jr., to the sort of flip way that he deals with the press sometimes, to his total lack of understanding of double switching, to overconfidence in his double switching ability. Like, he's just been a bad, he has not done many good things for the Mets. He handled the David Wright situation as well as he could last year, and that's about the best thing I could say for him. And I truly think any manager would have handled it exactly the same way.
Yeah. Yeah. Overall, I think that's fair.
So, I don't know. I don't wish the guy harm, but I do think that Van Wagenen probably has a different idea for who he wants managing the team next year. And unless Calloway surprises everybody, we're going to get that vision for next year.
Yeah, that's fair.
Well, I guess before we get to our music recommendations, we did want to talk about Jed Lowrie a little bit. So Lowrie suffered yet another setback. He was sent back to Port St. Lucie. He'll be reevaluated in 2 weeks, after which he will likely start yet another rehab assignment. When do you think we're going to see Jed Lowrie in a Mets uniform on the field?
I joked the other day that if he just stays in Port St. Lucie for the entire contract, that might make him the truest Met of all time.
You're not wrong.
Let's see. I'll go. Let's be optimistic. I feel like, despite the team being kind of a downer lately, I've been very much a downer on them in this episode. So let's be optimistic and say a month from when the hamstring thing happened. So go June 15th. Do they have a game that day? Let's look. It's very important that I get this right. Yes, June 15th. You know what? I'll go a day earlier. It's a 4-game series. Never mind. Sticking with it. June 15th at home against the Cardinals, Saturday night. Jed Lowrie comes in and helps salvage the series.
You ready for my hot take here?
Sure.
We see Cespedes in uniform before we see Lowrie in uniform.
Nice. Okay. We should put a poll out there on that one.
Yeah. That's a fun idea, actually. We should do that. but yeah, it's it just seems like there are so many injuries that, like, there are certain players that you just, from the moment the injury happens, you think, oh, we're never going to see that guy again. And right. Lowrie's capsule injury just seemed like it was going to be one of those lingering injuries that we weren't going to know, that there was a real chance of him being out for a long time. And it appears that is the case. I really don't know if we see him this season play baseball.
That would be something.
I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah, I do too. I want the Mets to win. And I like him as a player when he's out there.
Yes, yes. Again, we're not going to rehash the where do you play Jed Lowry conversation right now.
Right.
But I think that there are a lot of interesting things the Mets could do with Jed Lowry right now.
Yeah.
All right, a couple of quick rapid-fire questions for you I just thought up, and then we'll get to our music recommendations for this week. So, question number one. I'm trying to think of the least leading the witness way to answer this question.
All right.
If Robinson Cano is still hitting his current slash line on June 15th, we'll go with Jed Lowry Day.
Okay.
Will you be officially worried?
Sure. Yeah. Slightly. He's one of those guys, though, that I'm always going to expect a return to form. Until it doesn't happen for a long, long time, I'm always going to think he can come back. So I'll say I will be worried, but not overly worried.
So is there a date for this season that you will be overly worried?
August 1st? Is that okay. Too late?
No, I mean, look, you do you, man. You know, if you think August 1st is a reasonable time frame, then sure.
Yeah, I hope it's not that long.
I just fear that, I mean, the big fear is that he's washed up, which I don't think is the case, but that's the big fear. The secondary right. fear is that if he has this sort of, and perish the thought I'm even saying this, if he has sort of this sort of Jason Bay-ish first year, that no matter what he does from here on out, this is all we're ever going to hear about again.
That's true.
So I hope he gets hot real fast.
Yeah.
And I don't know if dropping him in the lineup is the answer. I don't think that he's not a rookie, right? You don't need to play those games with him. He just needs to start hitting somehow.
Yeah.
All right. So that was my first question.
All right.
Second question. At the end of the season, and not by any one particular metric, but just sort of overall looking at the team, who is the team's best non-Diaz reliever? And who is the team's best non-DeGrom starter?
I'll say Lugo and Syndergaard.
Safe bets.
Yeah. Lugo looks like he's the real deal. Gazelman's actually been a little bit better than I think people realize.
Yeah, I believe we're going to have a piece on that either late this week or early next week on the site.
Yeah.
He's really improved a lot lately.
Yeah, no, it's a nice-looking stat line. He's thrown a good amount of innings already.
He's throwing his slider a lot more, which is a good pitch for him.
Yeah. But yeah, Lugo, I feel like Lugo kind of fits into how I used to think about DeGrom. They're operating on different levels, obviously. But it was one of those, okay, he wasn't the most heralded prospect or anything. He comes up and puts up a nice ERA. Doesn't quite match it, and then last year goes back and pretty much regains his form. It's kind of crazy. In 2016, he had a 2.67 ERA, and last year he had a 2.66. Yeah. I would love if he became the Chris Davis with a K, Chris, of pitching. He hasn't done it yet, but that Chris Davis, as opposed to the Chris Davis who was 0 for 50, whatever.
Right, yeah.
With a C, shaming those of us with the normal spelling of the name. What was my point? Oh, right. Chris with a K Davis has hit 247 each season from 2015 through 2018, which is insane.
It's almost impossible to do.
Right. You couldn't... at this point, his career average is 247. Of course it is. He's how could it not be? You know, so it'd be fun if Seth Lugo was that kind of guy. If it was 2.67, 2.66, 2.65, we'll just ignore the 4.71 from 2017.
Right.
But my point is, you know, guy comes up, isn't the biggest name, performs well, and I go, okay, that's good. Let's see what happens and kind of question it. And my defense somewhere in that mix of everything was when we learned that he had the partial tear in his elbow.
Yes.
So I doubted him a little bit. And now I'm here realizing that was wrong. So, and Syndergaard, self-explanatory. Since I wrote the thing, it was four starts ago. The start right after it wasn't great, but the three after were overall. Even then, his last four starts, 3.54 ERA, and then I think it was a one something, or maybe a low twos in his last three starts. He's looking like the kind of pitcher that we know he is. So, yeah. Would you differ on either of those? You know, is Wheeler catching your attention?
Probably not, but I think I'd say Wheeler, just because I think that Wheeler has the potential to dazzle. We expect Syndergaard to do what Syndergaard's doing. And I think that Wheeler was this highly regarded prospect, which I still can't believe we got for three months of Carlos Beltran. Like, that's crazy. That's one of the greatest fleecings in Mets history, trade-wise. But, you know, I just think that Wheeler has the ability to put it all together at a really interesting time. Like, the second half of last season, he was a year and a half away from free agency, and just something clicked with him. And, you know, I don't think the Mets are going to extend him mid-season, although they should. Let me say that on the record. The Mets should absolutely be extending Zach Wheeler this season. Please, please do so, Mets. But I think just to watch him just get this much better after a couple of years of him flashing potential, and then for a few years of him not flashing anything, of just really looking like a broken pitcher, I just think he has the ability to be a more dazzling pitcher from that perspective. Even though I think Syndergaard will have better stuff, I think people are going to look at Wheeler and just be more impressed at how far he's come. But essentially, I think your answers are correct ones.
Beyonce, Ariana Grande, and Drake are talked about ad nauseum as celebrities, but there's one thing that's rarely discussed: their music.
On Switched on Pop, we go deep into the sounds of pop music to explain what it means, how it's made, and why it's so effective.
We talk with some of today's greatest artists, producers, and journalists to decode the musical logic behind our modern soundtrack and understand its role in our culture.
Switched on Pop will reveal for you how a secretive Swedish producer is behind many of the top 10 hits of the past 20 years.
And we'll uncover the ways that songwriters embed their political activism into today's most popular tracks.
We'll show you the surprising musical similarities between Cardi B and Taylor Swift.
And we'll even dive into the classical past to hear how the Jonas Brothers mirror Mozart's youthful party days.
I'm songwriter Charlie Harding.
And I'm musicologist Nate Sloan.
Join us on a journey through the world of popular music by subscribing to Switched on Pop on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app to get new episodes every Tuesday.
Hey, I'm Spencer Hall.
I'm Holly Anderson.
I'm Ryan Nanny.
I'm Jason Kirk, and we're the hosts of the Shutdown Fullcast, your Avengers of college football podcast. It says here in the script I'm to riff on what that means, and basically what I mean is it's all already spoiled.
Every Tuesday, we talk about everything from cooking disasters to pro wrestling to unfashionable pants we wore in middle school.
We also do talk about college football every now and then, like mascot fights, announcers fleeing the booth early, and unfashionable pants that coaches wear now.
If you want to take college football exactly as seriously as it should be taken, subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
And last one for now. Which do we see more of this year going forward? Do we see more how can I put this? Do we see more backup catchers coming for the Mets? Like, not Nito, essentially, you know. Do we see more backup catchers come up for the Mets? Or do we see more complete games from non-DeGrom starters?
I'll go complete games, non-DeGrom. If somebody gets hurt, that changes things. But regular operating, I think Nito is locked in.
You think he is?
Yeah. I don't know why, but I think he is.
I don't know what his deal is going to be. That's a guy I feel like there are certain players that you want your franchise to not bring up until they are absolutely ready. And I feel like Nito, is this Nito's third season already?
It is. The first one was 10 plate appearances, but it is. It's right. His third third one that shows up on FanGraphs and Baseball Reference.
Right, yeah. So it just seems like Nito was a player that they were relatively high on at a time, and they just insisted on bringing him up too early a bunch of times, and I wonder if he'll ever do what he could have done if he was handled properly.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll see. I would not be surprised if we saw three additional backup catchers get starts for the Mets this year.
Okay.
I don't know who those three guys
Rivera's, are. Rene Rivera's return.
Yes. Yeah, I don't know who those three guys are, but it just seems to me like that's going to be who it is. And it's going to piss me off every time that it's not Devin Mesoraco.
Yes.
I asked Allison this last week. Do you think there's any chance at a reconciliation there?
I'm going to say no. Just because it seemed like Mesoraco was so pissed. And also, I'm not criticizing him. But it does seem like perhaps there was this thought in his head that he wasn't, wherever he wound up, if he didn't make a major league roster, he was going to retire anyway.
Okay.
Basically, okay, I'm, he's not that old, but catching beats you up, and he's dealt with a lot of injuries.
Sure.
He's 30. He's had major league success, but obviously his career hasn't panned out the way that, you know, you might have hoped when he was the prospect.
Right.
A highly touted one at one point. So I don't know. It could have just been the Mets. It could just be the Mets. He could unretire as soon as the season ends and ask every team in the NL East to sign him just so he can take it out on them. I could be wrong, but there is part of me that thinks that maybe he kind of went into the offseason seeing where he could end up, and if it didn't happen, he was just going to retire.
Yeah.
And I would get that.
Yeah, so would I. It just seems to me like there's a drive in all the ball players I've ever spoken to. There's just this drive to keep playing. Very few players want to hang it up, especially at 30, coming off of their healthiest season in however many years. You know, it just seems it seems like he'd be an odd guy given his age, what happened last season, his spring, all of that. It seems odd to me that he would be ready to hang it up.
True. But he did have that little window where they had built in the thing that felt like it had never existed until this winter.
The upward mobility clause?
Right, yes.
Yes.
I forgot the, the terminology there. But it that did happen. No other team picked him up. The Mets say, we're going to send you to AAA, even though it didn't make any sense at the time. So maybe it was more a spur of the moment. Maybe it wasn't a thing he thought all off season, but getting rejected by the team that sounded like they promised you a major league roster spot and having every other team pass on you to take a spot with them. I could see that having an effect.
Sure.
But who knows? Even if that is the case, in a month, he might go, you know what? I really miss playing baseball. I hate the Mets, but I like my teammates. And I'll call them up and see if they'll, you know, send me to St. Lucie, prep for a couple of weeks, and make my way back up there. I think if the backup catcher turn begins, that might be around the time that he would do it. I'm still betting against it. I think it's pretty much over, but you never know.
To me, the speed in which Travis d'Arnaud found another team shows you the need for major league capable catching. And no one's saying that Mesoraco is an all-star anymore, but I mean, he's better than Travis d'Arnaud, probably.
Yeah. Yeah, the overall package, I think, is better.
Yeah.
I mean, I say this before d'Arnaud puts up a 900 OPS as a member of the Rays.
Exactly.
I wasn't worried about that happening in L.A. But in Tampa, it's like, oh, yeah, it's going to click.
All bets are off at that point, yeah.
Yeah. I didn't realize he actually got a plate appearance for the Dodgers.
Yeah. It goes on the baseball reference page forever. You can't take that away.
No, you can't. You can take away points off his stat line, or his slash line, though.
Yes, you certainly can. Well, let's get to our music recommendations, Chris. We missed yours last week.
Yes.
What are you recommending for us this week?
So there's two things, with the caveat that they are artists that I like who made albums that I'm not, I haven't made conclusions on yet.
Okay.
They haven't knocked me over, but Big Thief put out a new record called UFOF, and it's very, very, very calm. And I might at some point think, hey, this is a really good record. It just hasn't been the mood I was looking for yet.
Sure, I get that.
So bands sometimes do that. They'll put out a record that I love the band, and I can go, oh, all right, that record's for these circumstances, and kind of file it away for that. So that record, but, you know, they are a really good band.
That record did the thing for me, which I hate it when it happens, but it happens more than I would care to admit, which is I put on the album when I was doing something else, like I was at work or I was doing the dishes or whatever, and at some point I realized the album was still going, but I had no reaction to it in like 10 minutes.
Right.
And that's a bummer.
Yeah. So that was the one, and then the other, Here Comes the Cowboy by Mac DeMarco, and that one's chill, but not in the extreme way that the Big Thief record is. So Mac is always a good time. I've only listened to it once so far. It only came out a few days ago, but it was chill, but not too slow or not too quiet. Nothing on there that's quite as catchy as some of his catchiest stuff from the past records, but definitely solid. So yeah, those are my two. Big Thief, if you're in the mood for a really well arranged, quiet record by talented people, and Mac DeMarco, if you're just looking for, you know, a slightly more refined good time than he's had on some of the past records. I mean, I say that if you don't know Mac DeMarco, my two favorite stories, I'll keep it concise, but my two favorite things both came at the ends of shows that he played. One was at Webster Hall pre-renovation, where he did a medley of Enter Sandman and a couple other big songs. I forget what they were, but they just weaved back and forth through these three songs for like 20 minutes. And he crowd surfed for a good portion of that. And at a certain point, former Amazing Avenue writer Brock Mahan and I were the only two people holding him up as he grabbed a beer from the bar at the back of the floor at Webster Hall. And I'm holding his chest with both of my hands like, oh, I'm going to drop Mac DeMarco. So just that sort of raucousness, that fun time with it. That was a great example of it. Some at Radio City, the last 20 minutes were also kind of wild. But in that case, it was just kind of nonsensical wild. Like there was this, I don't even know what the right word is, like large puppet skeleton of a T-Rex. And he kind of just got in it and ran around in it for a while. And there wasn't really that much music going on. So yeah, that's my Mac DeMarco thing.
My favorite Mac DeMarco thing is at the end of his EP from a couple of years ago, he gave out his actual address and said, stop by for some coffee.
Yes, he did. Yep.
Which I was tempted to do a few times, but never actually did.
Yeah.
I think that'd be a very awkward thing to do. Be like, hey, I listened to your record. Here right. I am.
And for some reason, he moved to the other coast of the country shortly after.
Yeah, I wonder why that happened.
What about you?
So this is the weirdest recommendation I'm probably going to do all season.
Okay.
I'm warning everybody of that now. So, Chris, have you ever been a viewer of Mystery Science Theater 3000?
A little. I'm not an expert.
Okay.
But a little.
It played a huge role in my like middle and high school years. I still love Mystery Science Theater very, very much. One of the most famous episodes is called Manos, the Hands of Fate, which for a long time held the worst review, the worst like star ranking on IMDb possible. It was it was 1.9 stars, which was the lowest for any feature film for a long time. And it's this movie that supposedly was made on a dare, that the director was like, I can do a movie, watch me do it, and cast like local theater people and made this movie that is the slowest, like worst paced film of all time. It's as one of the lines in the Mystery Science Theater episode was, every frame of this film looks like someone's last known photo. Like, it's a perfect way to describe it. It's jarring, it's weird, but it has this really good jazz soundtrack. Like it's at least a drummer, a piano player, and a jazz flautist. Insert Anchorman Ron Burgundy joke here. But it's this like really haunting score, and they know it was composed because of the credits by guys named Robert Smith Jr. Not Robert Smith of The Cure, more than likely, and Russ Huddleston, rather. But they have no idea who played on it. All of that information has been lost to time. And the only way the soundtrack is to be heard is as part of the film, because they don't have master tapes of it. But that didn't stop somebody from a couple of years ago remastering it and releasing it on vinyl. And so it has some bits of dialogue from the film in it, not for like aesthetic reasons, but because to get the music, you need to have the dialogue, because that's the only place to get the music. The reason this came up was because this guy wears, the main character is just called like the Master, and he wears this black cloak with these red hands on them. And someone sent me a picture today of a guy cosplaying as Thanos, Hands of Fate, where he was wearing like this yellow cape and he has the Infinity Gauntlet on his like thing. It's a totally like niche, weird, dumb joke, but it got me thinking about this movie. And so I was like, let me look online and see if I can learn about this movie. And I saw that the soundtrack is available on vinyl. So I listened to it today at work, and it's really good. So I bought the vinyl from the Manos Hands of Fate soundtrack this week. And it's not on Spotify or Apple Music, but it's all on YouTube and it's on Bandcamp. So it's there are bits of it that remind me of at the Bad Plus a little bit. It was one of my favorite jazz bands. But just a really interesting sort of free jazz, very haunting music. So yeah, I wish I could say like I love the drumming of so and so, but literally nobody knows who that is. So yeah, that's my suggestion.
Nice.
I said it's the weirdest one I'm going to do all season. So
hey, I like it. I like weird.
Well, thanks for listening, folks. Tomorrow we'll have an Amazing Avenue in Conversation podcast. First one in a few weeks. We're excited about that. Go to AmazingAvenue.com to check out all of our and other people's writing about the Mets. We've had some really great stuff come out recently. Maggie Wiggin just wrote a great piece about Amed Rosario. Allison McKay just wrote something about Wilson Ramos. I said we hope to have something about Robert Gazelman in the next few days, so check out AmazingAvenue.com. Check out Amazing Avenue on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, at Amazing Avenue. You can email us. We haven't got an email in forever. Please email us, aaaudiopodcast@gmail.com. You can find Chris and I on Twitter. I am at Brian Needs a Nap. Chris is at Chris McShane. And until next time, let's go Mets.